For the week of January 10th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 307, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. All right, let's get this podcast on the road.
What the?
What? Come on. If they can curse on that piece of shit award show, the Golden Globes, we can sure as curse here on Showbiz Sandbox.
Yes, but when they did it on the Golden Globes,
TNT it wasn't.
Yeah, well, I can tell you this much, that the NBC broadcast I watched sounded where it was owned and you couldn't stand what the...
Stop being a bitch. Let's just get on with the show. Now you have to bleep out all those words. And you have to bleep them out because my mother listens to the podcast.
And it wouldn't make any sense unless I did.
That's right.
But I do actually owe our listeners an explanation, and you too, Michael. There have been several weeks where I've been gone for weeks at a time.
Oh, God.
Right?
Okay, I got it.
God. You knew where I was headed with that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, because I put the name Joaquin Guzman Lurea at the head of the show notes to say that, yes, I was actually out there interviewing El Chapo with Sean Penn.
Okay, okay. Who's Joaquin Guzman Lurea?
He's El Chapo.
Oh, that's his given name. I beg your pardon.
Yes. All right. When you're not, using his nickname, you can use
his... Well, when Sean isn't talking to his lawyers about hopefully potentially not being sued or having to... I don't know why they would call him to trial. What the heck could he offer up? But, what will he be listening to on our show?
Well, if Sean Penn isn't dealing with the authorities in one way or another, he could listen to this week's show where we are going to get ready for the Oscar nominations that will be announced, Thursday, January 14th. And how will we get ready? By looking at the many guilds that offered up even more favorites to consider, not to mention checking out what the Brits, they shined a spotlight on a few favorites of theirs via their BAFTA nominations over the weekend, as well as, of course, the winners of the Golden Globes, if anybody cares. The book industry is a global game more than ever. That makes the recent broadside by groups representing authors around the world especially notable. They're calling on publishers to offer author contracts that are fair and represent the way business is done in what is referred to as the 21st century. In a related note, we'll discuss the missing publishing executives in Hong Kong that many assume are being held in secret by the Chinese government. Sean Penn is on his way to interview them. During Inside Baseball, we'll do the math on Hollywood accounting. Producer Gavin Pallone wrote an op-ed for The Hollywood Reporter arguing that studios are dumb to cook the books. His reasoning? Most movies are bombs, and since the talent knows the studio screws them on the back end, they have no incentive to keep costs down on the front end. We go over the many accounting tricks the studios use and whether Pallone has a point. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the major entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at the box office around the world, of course. We get our information from RenTrak. We had Paul Derek Garabedian on the show last week. We also look at box office profits and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. Anywhere we can pull info on worldwide box office. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, again, Star Wars The Force Awakens, another $145 million worldwide. It opened in China with the best opening ever on a Saturday. There's an asterisk by that claim. But yes, the biggest Saturday opening. Saturday and Sunday, it made about $53 million. I'm not sure why it opened on a Saturday.
Oh, I can tell you why it opened on a Saturday.
Please do.
I'm sure that there are other reasons, but my speculation is that...
Oh, so you don't know, you're guessing.
I'm guessing that if it opened on a Friday, then they could say the biggest weekend opening ever, because of course Friday would be thrown in there. Now they can say, it had the biggest Saturday, because, we can't say the biggest opening ever, because frankly, it wasn't a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Well, so you mean China wanted to downplay the opening of the movie?
I have a feeling that's what it was.
Well, I don't know about that, because it didn't even beat Fast and Furious 7. That had a big opening single day on a Sunday. So it's not the single biggest day gross ever in China, nor is it the biggest gross on a Saturday and a Sunday. It just happens to be the biggest gross for a movie opening on a Saturday. So chances are, if that was the reasoning, they set up the movie to be able to claim it was the biggest something. Oh, if it had opened on a Friday, it may not have been able to make that claim. Or if it opened on Sunday, it may not have been able to make that claim. Well, of course, we'll never know. But it's a big opening. There's no question about that. How big it goes, how many kind of legs it has, I don't know. It only gets to play in China for 4 weeks, which certainly doesn't sound like a lot. But guess what? It's only played in 4 weeks so far in North America. 3.5 weeks, really. So it's made all this money in a remarkably short amount of time. In fact, for the first 21 days of its release in North America, Star Wars grossed $35 million a day on average.
Well, and I guess the reason it can only play for 4 weeks is because you Chinese New Year is coming up, which is a big movie-going season for the Chinese.
And they want to limit foreign box office to a degree. They want to be a big market. They're playing it close to the vest. They want to be a big market, but they also want to let their own movies flourish. So it's a difficult balance they're pulling off right now. But if you look at Star Wars overall, the episode, what is this, seven, right? Episode seven has grossed $1.7 billion worldwide. It's the third highest grossing movie of all time worldwide, trailing only the two James Cameron movies, Titanic and Avatar. And $1.7 billion is a lot of money, or as I like to call it, this week's Powerball.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm sure you're out there buying.
It's $1.3 billion this week's Powerball.
Yeah, and you have actually a better chance of being struck by lightning, not once, but twice, than you do of winning the Powerball.
Of course, I have a better chance of polling ahead of Ben Carson in the Republican primaries than I do of winning the Powerball.
Oh my God. Actually, that's probably true.
No, it is true. Only one person will win that, whereas five or six people will pull ahead of Ben Carson. At number two around the world is The Revenant, another $58 million, $60 million so far and counting. This is the Leonardo DiCaprio movie. It had a great opening. It's kind of double what critics were predicting. Critics, I should say, box office prognosticators. So it had a very strong opening, one of DiCaprio's best openings ever. And even before, I hope you saw the show notes over the week that I had this information about the movie, even before Hollywood Reporter Variety did a story saying Leonardo DiCaprio is a big star, because that's exactly the conclusion I was drawing. The Revenant cost $135 million to make, which is a hell of a lot of money, given that the director's never made a movie that made $135 million worldwide.
I know. There was also a lot of problems on that, and the budget ballooned.
Well, it went from 90 to 135, but still, it was a very pricey movie starting off out of the gate. It's a period piece. It's a Western. They were shooting it chronologically in the heartland. So it was a very hard movie to make, but Inarritu has never made a huge, massive box office hit, really. And Babel is the closest to it. And that had Brad Pitt, of course, but it only cost $20 million to make. So why would you give him $135 million? You didn't. You gave it to DiCaprio in a way. Because if you look at his movies, his last 12 or 14 movies, they are all exceptionally strong films. Not artistically speaking, but as far as their box office, he has really been a proven draw. He's making adult films for adults. They're not easily described. They're not franchise movies. And yet he's consistently delivered an audience. He's only really had like one or two real flops, maybe The Great Gatsby. That had a huge budget. And we have to look at Baz Luhrmann for that. But otherwise, he's had a string of solid successes to big hits. Most recently, of course, The Wolf of Wall Street and Django Unchained. So, you know, he's had a great run. And if you're looking for people making films for adults, DiCaprio is doing it, and he's bringing the audience with him.
This might be his year. I mean, one of the very few notes I made on the Golden Globes was the response he got when he won the Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Drama film. And, you know, he got a standing ovation, and people were cheering and boisterously.
But you felt like it was a heartfelt standing ovation.
Yes, it was like, you know, okay, look, you've given us a lot of money. You've given us a lot of years.
Maybe they just admire him as an actor.
And you've done a phenomenal job with your career and in the movies that you've done. Hey, more, you know, kudos to you. Well deserved.
I admire his choices over recent years. I just wish they were better movies by and large. They're not movies I love. I love Django Unchained. But other than that, there's really, you have to go back to Catch Me If You Can before there's a movie that I would have on my best of the year list.
Inception?
No, that wasn't on my best of the year list. It's certainly an interesting project. They're all interesting projects with interesting people. They're intelligent movies. I just don't love Wolf of Wall Street. I don't love, certainly, Shutter Island or Revolutionary Road or The Departed or The Aviator or Gangs of New York.
Wow. You know. Okay.
Or J. Edgar or Revolutionary Road or Body of Lies or Blood Diamonds. You know, those are bad movies. Gatsby's a bad movie. The others are not bad movies. They're just not good movies. But anyway. But he's an interesting actor, makes good choices, and he's definitely delivering an audience.
Well, look, I mean, you know, George Lucas turned to him and said, look, do you want to play Anakin Skywalker? And he said, let me think of, no, I don't, actually. I read the script and no.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. And number three around the world is Daddy's Home. This is the Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg comedy, another $25 million. It's at $150 million and counting. And number four is The Hateful Eight, $18 million over the weekend, $53 million worldwide. And number five is The Good Dinosaur, a Pixar film that is slowing down quite a bit around the world. It's in 61 territories. I'm sure it has some big ones to open up in still. It made $13 million over the weekend. It's at $266 million worldwide. And number six is a horror film that opened up mostly in the U.S., a little bit overseas. It's The Forest, poorly reviewed, poorly made, and it made $13 million, which is fine because it only cost $10 million to make. At number seven is Joy, the Jennifer Lawrence film, which she won Best Actress at the Golden Globes, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And, you know, I think
that's for a comedy, right?
Yes.
Joy, by the way, not a comedy any more than The Martian is a comedy.
Well, it's another story, but and we'll get to that. But I think, you know, she fares quite well at the Golden Globes. I don't know whether when put in all of Hollywood, you know, when you have everybody in the U.S. Kind of casting their ballots, I don't know whether
everybody
she can pull.
The U.S. casting their ballots. It's just the Oscar people.
Well, that's what I
mean.
You're
not saying she's going to win the Oscar just because she won. We know that the Globes do not lead directly to the Oscar.
Correct, yeah.
Joy made $12 million over the weekend. It's at $70 million and counting. It cost $60 million to make, so it's got quite a ways to go before it's a solid success story. One movie that is a solid success story is Detective Chinatown. This is the Chinese comedy mystery. It made another $11 million over the weekend, and it's closing in on $100 million, essentially from China and one other territory alone. And number nine is the Italian hit comedy Quo Vado. It made $11 million over the weekend, and it's at $52 million. And number 10 is Alvin and the Chipmunks, another $10 million, but again, a very expensive movie to make. It's only made $111 million worldwide. It really needs to pick up the pace overseas. At number 11 is The Big Short, which has obviously got its eye on the Oscars. It didn't have a good night at the Globes, but it's well-positioned to capitalize on a lot of Oscar nominations, which I'm sure it will get.
Speaking of nominations, you know, I'm watching the Golden Globes last night, and I thought Adam McKay had written The Big Short, okay, based on the Michael Lewis
book. I wonder
why
you watched him, but anyway.
But, well, and so I'm watching it, and they say, you know, nominated for Best Adaptation of or Best Comedy, whatever it was that it was nominated for screenplay. And Charles Randolph is mentioned. Charles Randolph was a client of mine over there at CAA.
Well, maybe if you paid better attention to his career, he'd still be a client of yours.
Well, you know what? it's been, what, 15 years? I think, you know, he's doing quite well for himself. He didn't need
Well, his movie, The Big Short, made $11 million. It's at $52 million worldwide, and it's doing just great. And number 12 is Sisters, the Jason Moore comedy that my friends went to see over the weekend. I say Jason Moore because he's a talented director. He did this. He did Pitch Perfect. He had big success on Broadway with Avenue Q and some other shows. And now he's turned himself into a profitable commercial filmmaker with Sisters, the Tina Fey, Amy Poehler comedy. Another $10 million over the weekend. It showed great legs. It's at $82 million worldwide. Number 13, here's a fun one. This is a TV movie made for the BBC. It's Sherlock, The Abominable Bride, and it stars Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman. It's a one-off special, really. It's not a whole from a whole season. It's set in Victorian times, unlike the series, which is generally set in the modern era. So it's a throwback to the Victorian era. They're playing Holmes and Watson, but it's in a whole different setting. They made it as a special to air in the UK. It played in some specialized theaters for like one night only, a Fathom event type thing here in the US. But it also opened up in some markets. It's made $9 million over the weekend and $28 million worldwide for a TV movie, which I don't know what it cost. I couldn't find out the budget, but it wasn't that much.
No, especially if it's on the BBC, it's not. It's definitely not going to cost a lot. And I watched.
Well, it's a period setting, and it's a, you know, I'm sure they have lots of sets available. But you know, I'm sure it costs more than your average 2 hours of television. I'm sure it costs $4, 5, 6 million.
Possibly.
You know, it's a one-off thing that create all new sets for it, and you know, they don't have costumes just waiting because the regular show is set in the modern era. So I'm sure it wasn't cheap. But it certainly didn't cost $10 or $20 million.
You know, it was fun watching Benedict Cumberbatch walk through that and Martin Freeman. But quite honestly, I had no idea what the heck was going on. I mean, people who had seen the series up to that point were amazed. Oh, look, they kind of moved the whole series to the Victorian times and they're redoing it. And I was like, okay, but you
but
know,
it didn't stand alone as a.
You know, it didn't engage me beyond watching those two actors go at it.
All right. Well, that's it for the worldwide box office. There's no competition in China for Star Wars until Kung Fu Panda 3 opens on January 29th. I guess maybe that's a co-production of some sort. Maybe that's why it's opening up close to the new year.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people have questioned that, actually. Why is this movie opening up in January? Normally, that would be like a March, April, May release. And you've hit the nail on the head. They made the film in China. And it's a co-production, and it was made, as Jeffrey Katzenberg said, we want to make Chinese films in China for the Chinese. Well, guess what? You have, and so you're going to release it in, you know, during Chinese New Year.
Hmm. And which is great for them.
Yeah, it's great.
And opening here in North America this weekend is Ride Along 2, the comedy with Ice Cube and Kevin Hart, and 13 Hours, Michael Bay's Benghazi drama, also known as Don't Vote for Hillary.
Is that what it's known as?
Yeah, it's known as by Michael Bay. Sure, he's a conservative, and he's made this movie to rip the lid open on the tragedy that was Benghazi and try and score political points for the Republicans. I wonder if Ride Along 2 will benefit from the effect of Straight Outta Compton.
Maybe. I don't know why you would assume that one would equate to the other, but
because Straight Outta Compton was about, you know, Ice Cube and the group he was in. And the glow of that movie might just carry over to Ride Along too. Certainly, Straight Outta Compton can hope to get lots of nominations come Oscar time this Thursday. I think it'll get a nomination for Best Picture. But if we want to see who's going to get nominated for Oscars, the best thing to do is not look at the Golden Globes, but look at the Guilds. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, because the Guilds, think about it. You have inside the Guilds, you have members that are part of a particular craft. So whether it's cinematography or editing or makeup or stunt, you're basically looking at the voting block that is the Oscars. So
everybody in each guild gets to vote for the Oscars, but no. At least their people focus on that craft, and they do have people in there that do vote on the Oscars. So the Producers Guild announced their 10 best films of the year. Who made the shortlist? Because they will, of course, name a final big winner. But right now, who do they say are the 10 best films of the year?
The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Brooklyn, Ex Machina, Mad Max Fury Road, The Martian, The Revenant, Sicario, Spotlight, and Straight Outta Compton. What is missing, okay, is Room, Carol, and a tiny film that...
Oh, don't do that. No, you promised.
Okay, Star Wars The Force Awakens.
That's right. Oh, and The Hateful Eight, right? That's not on there either, is it?
The Hateful Eight. A lot of people don't expect The Hateful Eight to get a nomination for Best Picture.
A lot of people? Why is that?
Because I said so.
Okay.
No, I mean, because of the review, basically people are saying, look, Tarantino needs to reinvent himself because he's doing the same thing over and over again. And if he does that, that's fine. But this is not one of his better films. That's the gist of my comment.
Well, his last two films were great. I haven't seen this one yet, but, you know, we'll have to see. So no real surprises. But, you know, the movies that are broad popular fare, The Martian, Mad Max Fury Road, or they're still into play here. And The Revenant is a big commercial hit, and Straight Outta Compton is a big commercial hit. So it could be a year where the Oscars will actually have lots of movies that people have seen.
Yes, true.
It could happen. They also named their top animated films of the year. No real surprise there either. Animalisa is one of them, as well as The Good Dinosaur, Inside Out, Minions, and The Peanuts Movie. I think it's a pretty slam dunk for Inside Out, no matter what gets nominated come Oscar time.
I agree. And what I want to know is, why would you nominate The Good Dinosaur? I mean,
what should be there in its place?
Why do you have to nominate anything if there's
five slots. Well, I think this year, because of the number of films that were eligible, five films were going to be nominated. So there's another movie, and there are smaller movies that are probably better that should have been. I mean, Minions isn't a good movie, for God's sake. The Good Dinosaur at least looks good and is, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's better than Minions.
Okay.
All right. So the Writers Guild also weighed in, didn't they?
This is actually bigger than the Producers Guild, in my opinion.
The Writers Guild?
The Writers Guild, the Directors Guild. Those branches are bigger.
When you look at the Writers Guild, they show such independence in what they nominate for Best Screenplay and Adapted Screenplay that, in fact, that doesn't always track towards what the Best Picture nominees will be, because they range widely, which is to their credit. I wish the Best Picture nominations ranged just as widely, but I would not look to the WGA to see what's going to get nominated for Best Picture. Having said that, who did they say were the best original screenplays of the year?
Bridge of Spies, Sicario, Spotlight, Straight Outta Compton, Trainwreck. So, you know, Amy
Schumer.
Would
you love to see Amy Schumer nominated for an Oscar?
It would be fun. I don't necessarily know. I mean, she's basically playing herself, so...
No, she's not. She's playing a persona and character she created that you may feel you know based on her movies and TV shows and stand-up, but that's a persona, a character. Groucho Marx wasn't playing himself. W.C. Fields wasn't playing himself. Neither is Amy Schumer.
Okay, fine.
The adapted screenplay nominees are The Big Short, Carol, The Martian, Steve Jobs, and Trumbo. For some reason, I feel like The Martian is going to be the ringer there for best adapted screenplay. I don't know why. I mean, The Big Short is a real challenge. Maybe that will be the one that triumphs come Oscar time. But those all seem like possibilities to be up there for the nominations for best screenplay. I don't think those will necessarily be the 10 movies named for best picture. I'm certain they won't be. I don't think Sicario or Trainwreck is probably in the running, nor maybe Trumbo and Steve Jobs still.
Right. And I don't know how you beat Aaron Sorkin. I mean, the guy just, you know, I guess you can't.
Oh, he's not going to win.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Well, that's how you beat him. Well, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, yeah, you know what I mean.
No.
Okay. I mean, it's like, you know, he's a big name. But I guess, look, Meryl Streep's a big name. She doesn't win every year.
She barely wins.
Yeah. The Big Short, there you go. You got Charles Randolph and Adam McKay again.
And if you're wondering about the people who aren't on those lists, there's all sorts of reasons. This is the Writers Guild of America nominations. And so there are films from overseas, like Mad Max Fury Road and Son of Saul and The Danish Girl, or all sorts of movies that for various reasons people aren't members or they weren't made here or whatever, that they're not eligible for, or perhaps they were overlooked. But I believe not eligible includes Quentin Tarantino for The Hateful Eight, those movies I mentioned, and a host of others like Brooklyn and 45 Years and Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. So just because it's not on this list doesn't mean it's not eligible for the Oscars and won't get in the mix come nomination time. If there is one area where Tarantino could get a nomination, it's certainly in writing or acting categories.
Yes, although he was not acting in the film, so he probably...
But he really promotes actors well. He gets great showcase roles for them. They're big, fun, juicy roles, and the Academy has had a long history of recognizing them.
Did you see what he said yesterday? I know you don't watch the Golden Globes, but when Ennio Morricone won for Best Score, he got up and he said, Ennio Morricone is the best composer of all time. And I'm not just talking about movie scores, that ghetto. I'm talking about Beethoven and Mozart.
That sounds like Tarantino.
I was like, you do realize you just offended a lot of people, right? Including some people you may have worked with in the past.
He didn't offend them. He's just saying he loves Ennio Morricone.
Okay, well, you all know, right.
Nobody's going to be offended. Ennio Morricone's like 120?
87.
And he's a legend.
87, yes.
Oh, he's just a kid. Well, here comes the real shocker for me. The cinematographers, they announced their nominations for the best shot films of the year. They, of course, named the artists who did them. They are Bridge of Spies, Carol, Mad Max Fury Road, The Revenant, and Sicario. All of them, to one degree or another, understandable, and except for Bridge of Spies, personally. But all of them understandable and well-deserved, I suppose. But really, the shocker to me, I cannot believe this, is Robert Richardson for The Hateful Eight. That is insane.
Well, why? Because they shot it on 65mm film.
Because it's a total... If there was one thing people love about this movie, it's the look of it. And it was done on 70mm, and they bought up 70mm machines and projectors, and it's an homage to Hollywood history and cinema, and it was beautifully done. If nothing else, people raved about the look of the film. I mean, and they also ignored Robert Richardson for Django Unchained, so he must be just a people must not like him. I think that's all I can understand.
Well, he's won Academy Awards in the past.
Yeah, no, he's won Oscars, but he's never won one from the cinematographers. So something's up there.
Really?
He's a pain to work with. I don't know, but I just thought that was insane.
I mean,
really?
He's won.
You're not shocked that this wasn't one of the five? You think Bridge of Spies deserves it?
No, I was a little shocked that he wasn't in the running there. I mean, he's won three Academy Awards. So maybe people are just jealous.
And he's never been nominated, I don't think, for a cinematographer.
Maybe he's not a member.
No, he is eligible. They talked about how he was snubbed again. There's no question he's a member. But I just thought that was, I mean, come on. If that labor of love doesn't get you a nomination, nothing ever will.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you this. If some of our listeners out there know why this might be, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or call, leave us a voicemail and let us know. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
So now the guilds are a good precursor to the Oscars. And of course, nobody will care about any of this except who wins, because then that maybe is another little spotlight into the Oscar. But come Thursday, all we'll talk about is the Oscar nominations. But one other little award that's a good precursor is the BAFTA.
Yes.
Great award in the UK. They've repositioned themselves to come before the Oscar nominations, even though the ballots are all in, right?
The ballots for the Oscars are all in, so
right.
Yes, yeah.
So the nominations are locked in stone, obviously, it's Thursday. But so the BAFTA nominations have come out, and they're a good indication of who might get nominated and win come Oscar time, given their new place in the calendar and the crossover between the U.S. and the U.K.
Well, so, you know what really counts, okay, here is, and by the way, you could say that Russell Crowe lost an Academy Award for his behavior at the BAFTA Awards back in 2001 for A Beautiful Mind when he went on a tirade.
I thought that was the Globes. It was at the BAFTAs.
It was at the BAFTAs.
Yeah. If you misbehave on the tour, you're doing 800 events. It doesn't have to be the BAFTAs or the Globes. If you're a jerk or you're surly if you pull a Robert Richardson, no, I'm sure he's a delightful man. But I mean, if for some reason you rub people the wrong way or you're ungracious, they'll say, oh, screw you. I'm not giving you an award. Right. That's always a possibility. And that happened to Crow, happened to others all the time. But yes, so yeah, you want to behave yourself on the tour. You want to endear yourself to people. Famously, Tom Hanks gave such a touching performance for Philadelphia that they wanted to see it again on the Oscars, you know.
Right.
Touching performance. I should say touching speech. Acceptance speech, which was a performance. But nonetheless, heartfelt and sincere. So the BAFTAs are here. Best film, best director is probably the best, you know, two things that we care about. What were the nominees for best film?
The nominees for best film from the British Academy of Film and Television Arts were The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Carol, The Revenant, and Spotlight.
And all of them could easily be on the short list for best director or for best film because there's going to be 9 or 10 movies on that list, aren't there?
There will be, yes.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that the director nominations almost completely match up, except Spotlight did not get a best director nomination. And that slot was taken up by Ridley Scott, whose The Martian was not nominated for best picture. So that's the sort of mix up there. They ignored those big flashy movies, The Martian and Mad Max Fury Road, in favor of films like Spotlight and The Revenant and Carol, Bridge of Spies and The Big Short.
Right. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think they're trying to nominate art films for best film, but they want to acknowledge, look, you're a really great director. You're also, you know, British.
I imagine they're going for the best films of the year. But that's certainly what happened at the Golden Globes. They love to nominate big, flashy movies, and they love to give awards to veterans. That's why the big winners of the night were The Revenant
for
best drama and The Martian for best comedy, strangely enough. And Stallone won best supporting actor for his work in Creed, but that's the Globes love their veteran actors. So does the Oscars, of course. But was his speech so touching and was the standing ovation as heartfelt as it was for DiCaprio? Do you feel like, yeah, that's going to get him closer to a nomination?
Yes, I do. However, he kind of went up and he gave a good speech. However, he forgot to thank the director and his co-star.
Oh, Jesus God, really?
Yeah, although I have to say, I honestly believe he did not think he would win. So he was completely ill-prepared. He went up there and was like,
Those are the only two people you should thank.
Yeah, and I think he was just like, I don't know.
I assume he made up for it in the back room, or do you not know?
I think he did, and quite honestly, when he was at CinemaCon this year, he said, listen, I had put Rocky Balboa aside. He was done. As far as I was concerned, I was never going to play this guy again. But then Ryan Coogler came up to me, and with Michael B. Jordan, and they had this great idea for how to revive the character, revive the storyline, and it was fantastic, and I couldn't say no. So he, you know, in kind of announcing this film and in promoting it, even before, you know, it was done, was talking about how those two particular, the actor and the director, were instrumental in getting it done.
Cool. Yeah, that's a shame. I'm sure he regrets it, whatever. You know, the Globes, I don't watch them. I don't watch anything except the Big Four. There's just too many award shows. But from all the reports, everybody said this year was just profanity filled. Like, for God's sakes, enough profanity. It's that you're not being edgy by cursing anymore.
Yeah,
it's just,
well,
you just look childish.
And there was one point where Ricky Gervais came out and said something to Mel Gibson. He said, let me ask you something. And the whole thing was bleeped out. You had no idea what anybody was laughing about or reacting to. It made no sense whatsoever. And it does not make for good television. The front page of the LA Times today said, what a bleeping show, or some ridiculous, they had to bleep out even the headline. Mm-hmm. And it just made it was.
Yeah, I mean, this show is pure television, so they don't have to have any guilds that say, no, you must give out the cinematographer award on camera, which I'm all for. But, you know, the Oscars, there's no restrictions on what they do, frankly, other than keeping the studios and the stars happy. So why they don't have a snappy, fun, well done show is beyond me. There's no excuse. Certainly, I like their awards for TV. I've said in the past they should split it up and set it up so this takes place right before the Emmy nominations are announced, because they do a great job of highlighting smaller shows. And this year, again, they did it. You know, they're more fun there than in the main categories. Mr. Robot for Best Drama, I'm delighted. I haven't seen most from The Jungle. By all accounts, it's just sort of that Golden Globe fancy for international actors and productions. I guess that's the only reason Mozart won and Gael García Bernal. But I'm thrilled that Rachel Bloom won for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She created the show. She stars in it. It's cool. It's fresh. It's a good show. People should check it out. It's the best new show of the season, as far as I'm concerned. And just like Gina Rodriguez winning for Jane the Virgin last year, I hope that people will wake up and check out Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Well, it certainly, I think, will help what The LA Times is calling little scene shows. I agree. I think Crazy Ex-Girlfriend deserves some viewing. Mozart in the Jungle is fantastic. I was really happy to see that. Oh, okay. That get some play.
People posited that was the least known show that was nominated, much less won.
Yeah, that's true.
And Transparent was the big show from them, from Amazon. And so to have Mozart win for Best Comedy this year was a bit of a shocker to everybody. But, you know, I haven't watched it. Maybe it's hilarious.
It's a lot of fun. It really is. And Gael Garcia Bernal is kind of Gustavo Dudamel. He's kind of riffing on Gustavo Dudamel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's fun. They're short episodes. They're half an hour. It's worth seeing. And I was surprised that Kimmy Schmidt wasn't in that mix. I guess it's American humor.
It's the Globes.
It's the Globes. And I'm sorry, but there are no movie stars in it. So there are no big stars. Therefore, we don't care. I did think Aziz Ansari, they did a cutaway of Aziz Ansari when they were announcing Best Actor in a Comedy Series. And of course, Jeffrey Tambor was nominated for Transparent, as was Gael Garcia Bernal for Mozart in the Jungle, and Aziz Ansari for Master of None. And when they cut to Ansari first, because, you know, they announced the nominations, he's there reading a book obscuring most of his face that says, "Losing to Jeffrey Tambor with Dignity." It was a perfect cutaway because, you know, it's kind of a rote thing. It's hackneyed and it's boring. And rather than, you know, be boring, he actually did something quite memorable with it. Personally, I don't think that was a real book. I think he kind of made it just for the awards. But if it was a real book, I wonder what the author would think that it was, you know, on television. Did he get any money for it being on television? I guess they don't have to get money for a book being
on television. No, you're happy to have your book seen on a TV show or movie. It gets a little plug. Maybe people will go out and buy it.
Ah, okay. But then what would happen to the money after it was purchased?
You're desperately trying to get us into publishing.
That's what I'm trying to do.
That's right.
Apparently, very unsuccessfully.
That's right. Well, the Authors Guild led a worldwide push over the last week to try and set new publishing contract standards. We've talked about this before, but now on January 5th, they posted an open letter to the publishing industry, and they were joined by the UK Society of Authors, the Authors Licensing and Collecting Society, the Irish Writers Union, along with a host of more than 24 writer advocacy organizations from Europe, Africa, Australia, and North America. So this was a worldwide effort to say, look, contracts are hopelessly out of date. You know, authors have no individual leverage because everybody walks in alone. And unless you're a big name author, you know, you can't argue. It's like going to McDonald's and saying, I'd like a bigger starting salary than minimum wage. It's not going to happen. So they're stepping forward and saying, look, we have got to redo these contracts. We've got to wake up to the new world we live in. We've got to be fair. You've got to be stop screwing people over on ebooks. You know, the royalty rates need to become in line with reality and on and on and on. So they're really making a big push. I thought they got a lot of attention. The fact that it was worldwide really, you know, I think woke people up. In the UK, the Society of Authors simultaneously released their own letter to their major, you know, bodies in the UK. And I think it's interesting. And we've mentioned some of these demands before, but they're straightforward. They're easy to follow. And this is what they say. What we demand is simple. Publishers need to revise many of their standard contract terms to make them more equitable. Basically, they're saying the contracts that most authors have to sign suck. They say authors should get at least 50% of ebook income, not 25%. That's net ebook income. They say they should not have their hands tied with non-compete and option clauses that can make it impossible for them to write new books without delay. They say they should not be forced to accept royalties that can decline by 50% when the publisher cuts its wholesale price by a penny. And they say they should be able to get the rights back when the publisher stops supporting a book. Basically, these contracts are a boilerplate. They've been around for many years, and they're based on things that don't work anymore, like a book being in print. Well, a book's in print forever now because the ebook copy is always available.
Right.
So these are just some of the issues they're raising up, and they're saying, look, we've got to pay attention to this. It's crazy. We've got to do something about this. You know, it's just wrong. And frankly, if there are no authors and people, you know, they looked at the poverty rate for authors in the UK, most authors are at the poverty level as far as their income from writing. And they're saying, look, if there are no writers, there are no books. So no matter what else happens, you have to make sure they don't starve to death.
Well, and I think the Authors Guild, every time they kind of release some kind of statement or letter, everybody at this point is rolling their eyes like, you again. But because you had all of these worldwide bodies and worldwide groups doing it at the same time and in conjunction with it, I think they really did, you're right, Michael, get a lot of press on this. And let's face it, they're right in certain instances where literally if a wholesale price of a book goes from $14.99 to $14.98, all of a sudden the author's commission goes down, or royalties go down by 50%. Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah. So it's an important issue. It's interesting, and there's a lot going on in the book world, obviously, as like new numbers for the year for libraries. Do you ever go to the library, Sperling? Do you take your kids to the library?
My kids love the library, actually. They love reading, and libraries are great. As a matter of fact, when I was in Sun Valley, I would go to the library every single day and get my work done there in front of a roaring fireplace.
Well, the nice thing is with kids, because you can go through books so quickly, it's nice to be able to go there and get a pile of books and come home and read them and then go back and get another pile of books, a few days later.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So I'm sure you buy them books as well, right?
Absolutely.
The ones that they love and they want to read again and again. Well, so your kids have checked out books from the library. Have you ever checked out an ebook from the library?
I have, actually. You can do that through Hoopla or a number of different services now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this year, according to Overdrive, and this is the company that provides sort of the back room digital needs for a lot of libraries, if you're checking out an ebook from your local library, chances are Overdrive is in there somewhere helping the library do that. They say that this year, 2015, 169 million ebooks were loaned out. And they say that's up 25% from the year before. Audiobooks are also up sharply. So you'd be no surprise, we've got a list of the top ebooks and audiobooks. They're mostly the same as you'd see on the bestseller list, like Girl on the Train and Gone Girl and All the Light We Cannot See, stuff like that. The Martian is in there, Ghost at a Watchman. The one difference is in audiobook, where you have two books that pushed up there, Amy Poehler's Yes, Please, and Harry Potter is still on there as well, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That's funny because I got my mom to check out that audiobook this year, so she must have contributed to that.
Well, I can tell you that the reason those two titles are on the list for audiobooks is because of the performances given within those audiobooks.
That's right. Amy Poehler very cleverly has guest people reading her book as her at certain portions of the book. So that's kind of fun. It was kind of a nice gimmick.
Yes.
But it's not the only news in publishing, is it? There is also some news from Hong Kong and China, isn't there?
Yeah, well, look, we all know that China, at least, is a major world power and a major economic force. Just look at what's gone on over the past week. But the more it integrates with the world economy, the less easily it can do business as usual when it comes to the economy and politics. Hence, the stock market turmoil, as I just mentioned, where China's pumping up the stock market bubble, which has finally collapsed, and hence the worldwide attention to the disappearance of five people in Hong Kong. They're the employees of Mighty Current, a Hong Kong publisher that often releases books critical of the Chinese government. They also have a bookstore called Causeway Bay Bookstore, and after years of developing relationships in international publishing, they also have friends overseas. The five people are believed to have been seized by the Chinese government, and now, in a nice bit of symmetry, five international organizations have brought attention to the case, the American Booksellers Association being one of them, the Association of American Publishers, the Authors Guild, so there they are again, the European and International Booksellers Federation, and Penn American Center, PEN, they've all spoken out and called on the Chinese government to explain what's exactly happening and called on the U.S. government to look into these disappearances and express their concern over it.
One thing I saw was I just saw in The Guardian that on Sunday, thousands of people actually demonstrated in the streets of Hong Kong demanding the release of these five people.
Well, and it's not only, I know that this is where we're on publishing news, it's not just publishers that are missing. There are film executives missing as well.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So it's a serious cause of concern, and it's something that you just can't get away with as easily when you try to be part of the world community.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing when you want to be, your own isolated economy and world power there. But when you actually are, want to be a part of the World Trade Organization and you have the world's eyes on you, letting big executives just disappear, it doesn't really doesn't sit well with the world.
Yeah, so hopefully those people will be safe. Hopefully they'll get returned. Hopefully the Chinese government will feel the heat. And
there'll just be an asterisk at some
point. Allow a little justice to prevail, yes.
Well, you know, ideally, a year from now, they'll all be safe and sound and you know, at home, back to their old jobs and, you know, be a big whoop.
All right. That's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, isn't it?
Yes. And Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Hey, let's stay in China. China's Wanda Group has made another significant foray into Hollywood. The company has purchased a controlling stake in Legendary. And this is a production company. They're a co-financier often with that Batman Begins and all the Batman franchise was under Legendary. And I think they're now moved from Warner Brothers to Universal. So what does this stake by Wanda, what does it get them? Well, head Thomas Tall and his team will remain in place at the company, now valued between $3 and $4 billion. They've got a potential franchise with iconic properties like King Kong and Godzilla. They've also got the biggest budget film in Chinese history, The Great Wall, a $150 million fantasy epic directed by Zhang Yimou and starring Matt Damon and Andy Lau. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big deal, but, you know, I always get nervous when you're not buying like a big library or something. Now, if you bought MGM, you got a library and you could create Turner Classic Movies. When you're buying just like an idea of a company name, I guess those franchises, the Universal Monster, not Universal, but the King Kong and Godzilla is the most valuable thing here. I don't know how many other properties they have like that. You've got the talent locked into place because Tom Tull and his team have been given a piece of the new company, so they have an incentive to stay on. But I always get nervous. If the talent leaves, then what do you have? You've got a name and nothing, right?
Well, you have a library.
But Legendary doesn't have a big library, does it?
Well, I mean, I just
assume it's not like a big studio. I mean, they're paying, you know, a lot of money.
Well, I mean, they have Warcraft coming up. Unbroken.
That looks like that's not a part of a library. They have some upcoming projects, and that one's based on a video game. The trailer looks pretty god-awful, but yeah, I know they've got upcoming projects.
Well,
and they do have
Batman movies, all the Batman movies.
But they don't control that library, do they?
They were co-financiers.
They have a piece of something that other people have, right?
Yeah, but you know, basically what happened was, as the international box office became more important, all of a sudden you had Warner Brothers and many other studios, by the way, say, we don't want to sell the rights in foreign territories for our films because that's where we're going to make 70% of the money back. But we don't want to take 100% of the risk on these films. So what do? We go for these co-financing deals where you keep the rights for the entire world, but you also have an investing group, in this case, Legendary Entertainment, come in and fund up to, I think it was like 80 movies in this case or some ridiculous number of movies.
But then you end up not, you know, you're like, you get to take all the risk and then they get more control over the profits and the money. I mean, right? You know.
No, because you're basically partners on it. That's why it was such a big deal when Legendary moved from Warner Brothers to Universal, because now Warner Brothers had to go out and find another co-financier. So they own pieces of 300 and Batman Begins and Watchmen.
Superman Returns.
And all the DC stuff. Clash of the Titans, The Hangover.
The Hangover. Mm-hmm.
So they own a lot of that stuff. And that is what's worth the money because you're basically financing.
Do they control it in the same way Warner Brothers controls it for North America? I would think their control of it would be more limited than... You know, you step in and offer money, it just doesn't seem like you're going to have the same control. But obviously, I don't know the deal that they have.
No, and it is not just, here's some money, no control. No, that's part of the issue. The hurdle with co-financing deals is that you do have a partner that you do have to consult. So it's not just, thanks for the money, we'll let you know if it makes anything.
Well, they have a piece of Jurassic World and Straight Outta Compton and Steve Jobs, three movies that are hoping to be mentioned come Oscar time.
Good point.
All right.
Now on to the Nobel Prizes, okay? Because back in 1965, the Nobel Prize for Literature controversially was awarded to...
Mikhail Sokolov.
Yes, thank you. I was looking at going, oh, I don't know. Now what am I going to say? The author, the author of And Quiet Flows the Dawn, D-O-N, not Dawn. In doing so, they honored a man who had denounced previous Nobel winner, Boris Pasternak. More importantly, the Nobel has opened up its archives 50 years later to show who was on the short list and the machinations to decide the winner that year. They passed over a hack, frankly, this Vladimir Nabokov guy, and Jorge Luis Borges. both of whom would never win the Nobel Prize for Literature. The Nobels considered giving a joint award to the government-approved Shalikov, I still can't pronounce his name, alongside Russian poet Anna, okay, do it again,
Akhmatova?
Michael. Akhmatova? Okay, Anna Akhmatova, who was excommunicated by the Soviet regime in 1946. She, too, would never win, big deal, or big whoop.
Well, I think it's a big deal because they opened up their archives. I mean, it's fun just to know that they passed over, you know, Vladimir yet again, and two people who should have won it. Not that And Quiet Fools at Dawn isn't a great book, and I'm glad that they sort of, you know, ignored the politics and just recognized the literature. Not that those two guys didn't deserve to win, but I just wish the Oscars would do it. 50 years later, let us know what happened in 1965. What's the big deal?
Oh, because,
you know, it would be
fun. Yeah, it would be if they did it decades down the road. I agree.
That's what I'm saying. It's 50 years later. You know, people will survive. They won't. Or you could do it 70 years later. You know, you've got the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s. You know, it would be fun every year to release the ballots from 70 years ago. Why not? They're all dead.
Well, and it would give them yet another
thing to plug.
Yeah, media hit. Okay, now, this next story I love just because of... Well, you'll see. Because the basic cable channel ABC Family has rebranded itself. It's now called Freeform, which the network says, and this is a quote, speaks to the network's ongoing priority to super serve becomers.
I love everything about their press release. They want to super serve their viewers, super serve them, and their viewers are called becomers.
Yeah. Now, you may be asking, what's a becomer? Because I know I was
asking that.
Yeah. Well, not surprisingly. Becomers fall in the desirable demo of ages 14 to 34. So basically half the human population. Give me a break, 14 to 34. That's such a wide swath. And ABC Family
said... But that means they're ignoring the rest of us.
I know. Well, ABC Family says they are, quote, fans on that epic adventure of becoming an adult. Traditionally, becomers are in high school, college, and the decade that follows and are navigating the wonderful, fun, exciting and scary time when you experience many of life's firsts, from first kiss to first kid. In fact, as a matter of fact, and that's the end of the quote, but I will tell you, for those listening who don't know this, the first kiss often leads to the first kid.
That's not true, you pervert. Why would you be kissing people? But I love that they say traditionally becomers on. Traditionally, there's no such thing as a becomer. There's no tradition around becomers.
It doesn't exist.
You made this up. Like last week or something. Talk about Freeform.
What, the millennial generation wasn't good enough for you? You had to go and invent your own, like, Generation
All
X?
Becomers at heart.
Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. No, I shouldn't say that because what matters here is the Freeform, not the stupid press release. They've rebranded themselves Freeform. It seems silly, but it's very dangerous and difficult to do. You know,
that's true.
A big risk. You're not ABC Family anymore. You're Freeform. People might just go, well, that's stupid, and never pay attention to it again, or they'll love it. You know, it's just it's a very, very difficult, risky thing to do. I'm sure they tested it out the wazoo. Whether it'll work, I don't know.
Well, look at Syfy. Sci-fi channel, but it's spelled S-Y-F-Y. Yeah.
That was so annoying. It's pointless.
Yeah. I guess we're going to skip this story about Netflix going into 130 countries, right? Let's just,
I thought it was just, they're like, oh, we're in 130 countries, but we're not in their language. It's like a gimmick. Like they're in Turkey, Russia, and Poland, but they're not available in Turkish, Russian, or Polish. Well, so what then? Like, it's just a flashy thing. I mean, yeah, they're in a lot of countries, but you know, if you're not making yourself available in that country's actual language, to me, you're just turning the lights on and it's sort of a stunt. Call me when you're actually available. If I'm in Spain and you put up Netflix in Spain, I kind of expect it to be in Spanish.
Yeah, well, the big deal there really is the fact that they're overcoming the legislative hurdles of launching in those countries. But that would have happened anyway. They're just...
But then they haven't really launched in there if most of the people in those countries can't watch their network unless they speak English.
Yeah, well...
I think it's a fine stunt. It shows they're a big worldwide brand, just like... Fox is all over the world and other channels and BBC and other people are available all over the world in various ways, shapes, and forms. It's notable, but it is sort of a big whoop because it's more of a stunt than an actual accomplishment.
Well, you know, another name brand that or a name that's become a name brand is Coachella, right? If I say Coachella, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm not talking...
Yes, it's that thing you do every year.
Yes. As a matter of fact, that is the brand that I'm referring to. When you think of Coachella, you think of me going there every single year. Although not for the past 2 years. But hey, you know what? Guns N' Roses is indeed reuniting. And we do mean Axl and Slash. And if you need the last names there. First of all, I'll tell you one is Rose and the other doesn't have a last name. That's the big news from the Coachella lineup announced last week. Less earth-shaking is the reunion of LCD Sound System, which have not so epic for your break. You know, they kind of said, oh, this is our last show. Let's do a movie about it. And then they were breaking up. We're never going to perform again. No more records except 4 years from now when we'll release a record and go on tour.
Are they doing a record tour as well?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they are. Oh, and that's what the big... I'm surprised that you didn't think this was bigger news because, you know... James Murphy had to come out and say, listen, I didn't think this would be such a big deal that you guys would like go haywire over this, that we're coming back. And we thought you'd be happy. Not that, you know, you're all upset now that we're coming back. Good grief. my question is that really a reunion? No, it's they're just coming back. Other acts worth checking out include everyone from Courtney Barnett. Indeed, she is great. And Chris Stapleton to Sufjan Stevens. Sufjan. Yes, I know. I just wonder what it's going to be like hearing that last album with 80,000 of your closest friends since it's this small.
They'll all be weeping.
Exactly. Pass out the Kleenex. Ice Cube will be there. Calvin Harris. And of course, everybody's wondering if Taylor Swift will show up. And about two dozen more acts. So that's Coachella. Then you've got the Governor's Ball trying to keep pace with Coachella, right? That's over by you, Michael, on the East Coast. There you've got Kanye West, who's played
again.
Yeah, he's played the Governor's Ball in the past and Coachella. The Strokes and the Killers, both of whom have played, I believe, I know they've played Coachella. I think both may have even played the Governor's Ball. So was all of this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? I mean, yeah, Guns N' Roses, if they actually put out new music or are actually good in concert and get along, then that'll be a big deal. You know, let them be musically satisfying, then okay. But, you know, given Slash's performances over the last two decades, I'm not so convinced. LCD Sound System is kind of a joke. I mean, I'm not angry at him, but like, for God's sakes, man, why did you have an elaborate goodbye? You know, it's just, it's a little silly.
Yeah, I think what happened is he was really, really tired of that particular life and lifestyle. I mean, if you see the movie, he's very honest about it.
I understand. He's allowed to say I'm done, but like, well, it's over. It's the end of an era. Okay, we're back. You know, it's a little, you look silly. And you don't get angry that you look silly because you do look silly. It's your own fault. You could have just said, hey, we're taking a break. Maybe we'll get back together again. I don't know. But for now, this is our goodbye. You know, instead it was like, this was it, baby. Off into the sunset.
Well, speaking of curious moves, Sean Penn, who has long pursued his interests in journalism and writing for various outlets, scored a coup Barbara Walters would be proud of, or at least afraid of. With the help of Mexican actress Kate Del Castillo, he managed to meet with Joaquin Guzman Larrea, the notorious drug kingpin known as El Chapo, who had escaped from prison and was one of the most wanted men in the world. He not only escaped from prison once, but twice. Penn's actual interview proved anticlimactic since he never actually got to do a formal sit-down. Still, the gonzo reporting of how Penn clandestinely traveled to Mexico and met with the man is engrossing reading. The article notes, and this is the article in Rolling Stone magazine, that the entire piece was submitted to El Chapo before publication and he requested no changes. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a journalistic coup. Firsthand, and Sean Penn is a journalist. He's done it for years. He writes. He's a good writer. He's interesting. He does a lot of different interesting reporting for different outlets in the U.S. and around the world. It's bizarre. You know, it's this crazy thing. They're probably lucky that he got captured again, as people have said. You know, if he was still out on the loose and Sean Penn had published an interview, that would have been a lot more problematic as far as bad press and publicity. But they are also getting blowback. Why Rolling Stone would say, you know, say, oh yeah, sure, you can, you know, let us know if you want any changes. And they said, well, you know, if he'd said make big changes, we would have said no or whatever. But, you know, like, you're not supposed to give that to anybody. If you're a real journalist, you don't give Madonna approval over the article. You don't let her see the article before it gets printed. Why would you let a criminal?
Well, and frankly, why would you even have to admit it? I mean, it's not like he's going to say anything about it.
Well, better to admit it than to let it come out. No, so I mean, they were wise to put it out there because people knew in their group and it would have probably gotten out eventually. So yeah, if that's the deal you made, you damn well better let people know. You at least be straightforward and upfront. So that was the right decision, lying about or hiding it, because nobody would think you did that. So, and then Jan Wenner said, oh, big deal. We've let people see their quotes. I'm like, well, you shouldn't.
Yeah,
that's sort of sad. You know, that's what you do if you're at Star Magazine or the National Enquirer. It's not what you do when you're at a respected outlet. You know, the New York Times isn't supposed to do that. You know, there may be some rare case where there might be something, but yeah, no, basically you're not supposed to do that. So why you do it for a criminal when you wouldn't do it for a pop star, I don't quite get. But it was an interesting piece. He did show, of course, as people know, the government military in cahoots with El Chapo. It did create some interesting color, and this, you know, guy is a vile person, but it was an interesting story.
Yes. What I will say is, yes, vile person. At the end of the day.
And there's a long history of people interviewing people who are wanted or criminals or on the lam. I mean, people interviewed Osama bin Laden after 9/11. That's a valid journalistic thing to do. You know, it's not like, how dare you speak to a criminal? Well, no, it happens. You know, there was a great story, I think, Variety or Hollywood Reporter mentioned how, like, Pancho Villa, you know, he made a deal with Hollywood while he was running a revolution, you know, so they got the film rights to him and they filmed actual battles. And that, you know, sort of the basis for that HBO movie and Pancho Villa as himself. You know, it's a crazy world out there.
Well, and let's face it, he got caught because he was trying, you know, El Chapo was trying to make a movie.
Well, that's what they say. That's what they say. I don't know that that's true. They now immediately claimed, oh, because he spoke to those Sean Penn, that's why we caught him. I'm not sure that that's true necessarily, because it seemed like, according to the article, they had targeted the compound even before, you know, I mean, I don't know. It seems that's possible, of course, but who knows?
I love the fact that, like, you know, when he's talking to Sean Penn about the movie business, he says, I don't know, the risk return. But, you know, what he does say, and, you know, I'm not saying he's a decent guy at all, El
Chapo. What do you mean? Of course you're not. He's not. He's evil.
Right.
He's
what scum. I'm saying is what he says is in that, you know, I had to turn to drugs to eat and to survive where I'm from in Mexico. And by the way, when I disappear, it's not going to be the end of it.
And that's called self-justification, because a lot of people grow up in poverty and they don't commit crimes and kill and murder people and, you know, deal in illegal drugs. Most people who grow up in grinding poverty do not turn to a life of violence and crime. They actually strive and struggle to maintain their dignity in their lives. So yeah, that's a lie. That's a pathetic lie.
Well, I want to see.
I'm not saying that if I wasn't in grinding poverty, I wouldn't turn to a life of crime. Maybe I would, but I wouldn't pretend that somehow that was my, I had no choice, because that's a lie. Just like you have a choice not to do your meth, Sperling.
That's true. You know, I'm now addicted. So yeah. What is meth again?
Keep going.
Okay. So Michael, I need you to, say goodbye, actually. Not to our audience, but to Jumbo. In fact, he, in a significant sign of the times, Ringling Brothers announced it would be retiring elephants from the most famous show on earth. But were they named Jumbo? I thought they were named Dumbo. Anyway, they'd already announced the elephants would be gone in the next few years, but with increasing scrutiny over animal care and cities and towns passing anti-elephant ordinances to prevent elephants being used for entertainment purposes, Ringling bowed to the inevitable. The 11 or so elephants, the 11 elephants are on tour right now, will be retired to a home in Central Florida, where elephants, hail from, actually. Some 30 elephants already reside there, actually. So I'm...
That's where winter home is for circus folk.
Okay.
All types of... It is. Central Florida, that's where circus folk have always gone in the winter. You know, when they're not on tour, there's always been training schools and homes in Central Florida where circus folk hang out.
Including the elephants, apparently. Big deal.
It's a big deal. You know, it's a big end of an era. I mean, once upon a time, you know, the circus was such a huge industry and such a big center of popular culture. Now, of course, it's faded off to the side, though obviously Cirque du Soleil and some more modern type of entertainment have taken the fore. But, you know, it's really the end of an era. The elephants, I think, they say, oh, no, we just sped it up because we saw how quickly we could get these home ready for them. But that's, I think, a bit of a lie. I think they were just, oh, we'll get rid of them, you know, a couple years down the road. But they just saw the increasing legal hurdles to having the tour with the elephants that they finally just decided it's more trouble than it's worth.
Well, you know, every year, Michael, you're in New York, right? So every year when the circus comes to town, they have to walk the elephants into Manhattan through the Lincoln Tunnel or the Holland Tunnel. You know, they close it down to walk the elephants through there.
Well, I don't know if I have to. It's, but the whole parade into Madison Square Garden is sort of a big sort of, you know, that's what they do in every town historically. You know, they have the big parade into town to gain attention. Well, I don't think that it's not possible for them to do it any other way. I think it's part of the whole shtick of gaining attention. Hey, we're coming to town. And they get attention and on the news and people see it. It's, you know, they've been doing it since the 1800s.
Well, okay, then. Then let's move on to Relativity, which has acquired Trigger Street. Now, if you don't know what Trigger Street is, it is the production company of actor Kevin Spacey and producer Dana Brunetti. The reason that Relativity acquired Trigger Street, they want Kevin Spacey and Brunetti to take over Relativity's film and TV division. Spacey's Trigger Street has produced works like The House of Cards, The Social Network, and 50 Shades of Grey. Relativity is coming out of bankruptcy, and this deal had to be approved by the courts overseeing the bankruptcy. Spacey's title will be Chairman of Relativity Studios, with Brunetti as president. I'm wondering what Ryan Kavanaugh will be then, if these guys are going to be chairman and president.
Of studios.
Oh, okay. As opposed to the CEO of the entire company. Okay, right. I see. All right, well, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Spacey's done a great job at the old Vic. That was where he went to, he launched this company with Brunetti. Then he went to the old Vic and has been there for 11 years, and they were in dire shape. Possibly shutting down. He turned around that venue. He got strong critical reviews, ultimately left him in good financial shape, did a great job with the theater community in the UK. Now he wants to play on an even bigger stage, making movies. Actors have gone back and forth to movies. Sometimes they have good success, like United Artists back in the day with Mary Pickford. Other times they have poor success, like with United Artists and Tom Cruise. So can Spacey do it? Why not?
Yeah, I think he has, as good a shot as anybody. And
yeah, he's shown a good backroom, savvy. It's not like this is a new thing for him. He's sort of worked his way up to this after, Trigger Street and the old Vic. I think it's a next sort of logical step.
Yeah, now I wonder, because Relativity, much like Legendary, was one of those co-financing companies, okay? So Relativity did it with Sony and Universal. I wonder if, and what killed Relativity was going out there and trying to make and distribute movies rather than just co-finance right. them. So I wonder if they're going to kind of start falling back onto we'll make them and somebody else can distribute them in that way.
Right. The real issue is how much money will they have? What kind of budget? You can't do anything without, you have to be able to fail a bunch of times before you succeed, because most of the time you're going to fail. So we'll have to see what sort of leash they're on, what budget they have, what kind of deals they can make. It's coming out of bankruptcy. So, to give him a fair shake, you got to actually see what sort of what he's given to work with.
Now, Broadway had a strong year last year in 2015, with strong numbers hitting $1.35 billion, just a tad below the $1.36 billion reached in 2014. Attendance was also down by a modest 150,000 tickets. God, if they could have made Hamilton play Madison Square Garden three times, I would have taken it. But the calendar helped 2016 get off to a rip-roaring start, with apparently everyone who couldn't get a ticket to Hamilton deciding to see damn near anything else. 20 shows passed $1 million in sales over the New Year's weekend, with four hitting more than $2 million. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a good start to the new year, and we'll have to see where it ends up. This weekend's grosses just came out, and they're back down to earth a little bit, but still, you've got 8 shows at just about $1 billion or more. So, it's a torrid pace, and we'll have to see, how the year goes. But, it's a good way to start the year, that's for damn sure. And, of course, Broadway is just the start. You can lose money on Broadway and have success on the road, have success overseas, because there's a lot more money to be made there than there ever was before.
Well, speaking of reviews from 2015, we did box office last week. We just did Broadway. Hey, how about home entertainment? Because in the U.S., which is the only territory we have figures for, home entertainment spending holds essentially steady in 2015 at about $18 billion. However, that figure conflates some competing industries. Netflix is growing bigger than ever, underlining that point by turning the lights on in more than 130 companies, which we just mentioned. They announced that during CES. But streaming video on demand feels like a different business than, say, retail DVD sales and rental, not to mention on demand. And what about cable subscriptions and premium channels offering themselves a la carte, like HBO Now and HBO Go and HBO this and that? I don't know. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop because it's a little confusing as far as what we should see. But if you break it down, maybe it makes more sense, right?
I suppose. I mean, I can tell you this. When they talk about home entertainment, okay, when they say home entertainment figures, they are saying the following. They are saying DVD sales, so home video sales.
And that was about $6.1 billion in 2015.
Okay, and on-demand sales, so transactions, not subscriptions.
Meaning like video on demand or if you buy a digital download?
Correct.
That's like iTunes or Amazon. That's another $2 billion.
Okay. They're not saying, that I know of, they're not saying, hey, here's how much Amazon Prime made.
Well, they can't, because that's again, you get a lot more than just the streaming video that they offer.
Right.
You get a lot of other things. So yeah, that's not broken out at all.
I don't think they're saying Netflix at all.
Well, would be streaming video on demand, and that's about $5 billion.
Right, so but I don't think they're saying
that. This number does include that, yes.
It does include that.
That's why we're putting a question mark by it. Because you're including Netflix and streaming video on demand, which is sort of a different world than DVD, Blu-ray. They're sort of a competing, but it's sort of the big pie. But then if you have streaming video on demand like Netflix, what about HBO Now? What about cable subscriptions? You know.
Well, cable subscriptions definitely would not be counted.
Right.
Okay, that's
not? That's home entertainment.
Yeah, it's more of a service, and that would not be considered home entertainment.
So why would 500 channels be considered a service, but one channel be not be considered a service?
You mean Netflix?
Yeah.
Because Netflix.
Or HBO Now or whatever.
Yeah, no, believe me, I'm just as curious as you are about how these figures are tallied.
Well, there's also disc rentals. You know, there's still Redbox and other people renting out discs. So that's another $3 billion. So you've got $5 billion for streaming video on demand, $6 billion for sell through. In physical product, that's DVD and Blu-ray. Another couple billion for sell-through digitally or video on demand, where you just press play. And there's rentals, another $3 billion. So that's where you get to the roughly $18 billion a year that's spent on home entertainment.
And when you hear DVD rentals or Blu-ray rentals, okay, and you hear $3 billion, you think, oh, the studio is going to make some money on... No, they made money selling the disc to Redbox or to Netflix.
Right, the days where they got a cut of the profits are gone, yeah.
But I think so, yeah. Blockbuster, they notoriously cut a deal with Blockbuster, okay? Where Blockbuster...
It was notorious, but yeah.
Well, okay. In any case, I guess what you're saying is until we can figure out how this was done, big whoop.
Yes.
Okay, well then that moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I'm not sure that this week's story really affects anybody that doesn't work in the entertainment industry, but Gavin Pallone, okay, he's a producer, director. He was
Curb Your Enthusiasm, Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, he was a manager. He was an agent over at UTA. He's kind of done it all in a way. He's very well known. And I'd like to thank him because, you know what? I reached out to him and asked if he'd be on the show this week. And he said, look, I'd love to. I've got all this other stuff to do. And we tried to work out schedules and it just didn't work out. But you know what? So often when people are busy and they have schedule conflicts, they just don't get back to you. And Mr. Pallone did. And I have to say, I credit him for that. That was really great. But, you know, he makes all these movies. He made movies like Zombieland, in fact. Mm-hmm. And he writes for the Hollywood. There may be three of him, actually, because he does all these jobs. He writes a regular column for The Hollywood Reporter, and in this week's column, he goes over the many shenanigans that contribute to what is loosely known as Hollywood accounting. And that is, of course, when we say Hollywood accounting, we put quotes around it because it's cooking the books so that even talent with serious stakes in profitability, beyond the illusory net profits, must sue in order to see what the real numbers are.
And it's true. I mean, he covers a lot of familiar territory because we've heard about a lot of these things before. But he sort of brings it all together and sort of listing them all at once is sort of a little eye-opening. And he does make an interesting point. He's probably not the first person to say it, but it was a little new to me, or I hadn't thought about it in a while. He says studios are screwing themselves over because when talent knows they're getting screwed in the back end, they have no incentive to worry about the front end. And that's why you see actors lingering in their trailer. That's why directors, we'll quit, we'll do it. You know, there's no concern about runaway budget costs when you're making a movie because it's not your money. And hell, they're not going to, you know, it's not going to make a difference to what you make in the back end. So why should you care? And that's why you have some legendary excesses and wastes that can typify Hollywood movies and TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely right. I mean, in any other company, if you told all the employees of the company, look, you'll get a bigger bonus at the end of the year if we can keep costs down.
So typically what happens, right? In
right.
most companies, because you're not a freelancer that's just doing one particular job. You're actually at the company and you know, hey, waste money, you know, guess what?
Yeah, we spend $1 million in copy paper. Hey, make less copies this year and we spend $500,000, that's $500,000 extra dollars we can put towards bonuses. All of a sudden, you see people really, you know, making a concerted effort to rein in costs and to watch how money is spent. And basically, what Mr. Pallone is saying here is, hey, because everybody knows that your profit percentage is kind of a joke, you're never actually going to see anything from it.
I mean, net profit, yeah.
Yeah, your net profit. First of all, you know, you're going to have to go to court.
The big stars make money, but that's like, you know, 1% of the people.
Yeah, you're never going to see any part of that. And when you do, you're going to have to sue to get it. So what's the point? You may as well just spend it all now, since you're never going to see it on the back end.
That's right. So he talks about, he has some good dirt, giving some interesting examples of how studios are always adversarial. Anytime he talks to someone, he says, yeah, if you ask them to write a small check, like for $1,000 or whatever, but you ask them to write a check to an artist for $100,000, oh, wait a second. And they always try to figure out ways to minimize the money they pay out. And he says, look, all these lawsuits we've had, almost never do you find out that a studio accidentally overpaid the talent. Somehow they're always accidentally underpaying the talent.
Yeah, that's true.
And even honest mistakes become dishonest because of the way this is all done. You know, you bring in auditors, you bring in accountants and people, and they all have to sign non-disclosure agreements. Even if you're working for two people who worked on the same movie and have the similar or same contract, if you find a mistake, even an honest mistake that the studio did, and you catch them on it, and then they have to pay up and do that, they're not going to tell the other people in the movie, oh, we made a mistake, you're owed more money. They don't ever do that. Unless they sue, they're not going to ever know that that happened. And so an honest mistake even can become a dishonest one because it stays in place and the studio never has an incentive to come forward and say what's going on.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating read. And, you know, it reminded me of there's two different lawsuits going on right now, one of which is for Bones, and we've talked about it. The other of which we've talked about, too, which is Frank
Walking Dead.
Walking Dead, Frank Darabont. And he just seems to not care at all. He's, you know what? I'll go to court. I'll go to trial. Let's go. Because he just doesn't seem to want to settle.
Well, why should he? Yeah. Yeah. As Pallone said, because there's enough money there that it's worth his time. As Pallone says, most of the time, it's just not worth your money and time. Because you know if you're going to audit them, that's going to take years, 2, 3, or 4 years, because they stonewall. And then if that's successful and you find something, then you'll probably have to take them to court. And that means more years and more money. He says, well, look, if they owe you $80,000, you're going to spend $50,000 on the audit alone. Then you got to get lawyers and you got to go to court. It just doesn't make sense. And plus, you want to do business with them again. So the incentive is to keep you away from doing and getting the money that they probably do owe you.
Yeah, I don't know how you fix that problem.
Well, he says it. He says you need, you know, a smart studio would come forward and say, hey, we're going to be more transparent. We're going to have some independent auditing firm come in. We're going to do, you know, proper accounting practices. And we're going to attract artists who are going to know, hey, you've got skin in the game. The cheaper we make the movie, the more likely you are to see actual profits from it. Because even these movies we talk about that aren't profitable, and I'm putting that in quotes, we know eventually most of them are making money because obviously they're not making, you know, 90% of the movies aren't bombs or they'd be out of business, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. That, you know what? You hit the nail on the head. I was talking to a CFO actually at the premiere of Bridge of Spies, a CFO of a big production company, and he was saying that he always gets riled when he reads you know, oh, this movie's a flop and this movie's a bomb and that movie's never going to make any money because, you know, it didn't do well necessarily theatrically, or it may have made, you know, 3/4 of its budget back theatrically. And he says, you know what? The lifespan of that movie is going to be 2 decades long. And believe me, you will eventually make your money back. Now, you might not make much more than that, but you will eventually make your money back on just about every film you make. It may take forever and way longer than most investors are willing to take.
That's why it's a good business, and that's why libraries are the most valuable thing to have.
Exactly. Now, he did admit, you know what? Every once in a while, you get like a Heaven's Gate or some movie that they spend way too much money on, okay? And then there's just no way to ever make even a break-even.
And as we said at the first time you mentioned this guy, if he's honest, he knows the studios do everything they can to hide the fact that most of their movies actually end up making money.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Legally, they refuse to admit their movies make money.
And, well, he's one of the people that has to go in and say, guys, you know, we produce this movie. So can, you know, that's one of his main jobs is doing just that. So,
well,
yes.
Good luck with that.
Exactly. May the force be with you. No pun intended. But the force, unfortunately, wasn't with anybody last night after the Golden Globe.
I don't know. That's a terrible, terrible. Yeah, no, sad obituary notice, obviously.
I can never get into obituaries with a good segue.
Let's move on to obituaries, where sadly, of course, everybody knows by now that David Bowie's dead. He died at 69, a shock to everybody, but not to everybody. This, to me, was the most interesting thing about David Bowie's death. The fact that the obituaries mentioned he's had been fighting cancer for 18 months. And that people around him knew, of course, and he was designing his last album and videos as sort of a farewell to life and his thoughts on death. But like that word never got out. So the fact that a lot of people had to know who worked with his off-Broadway show, Lazarus, which is still playing with Michael C. Hall, people who worked on his new album, people at the record label, in theater, all around him, all these people, a lot of people had to know that he was not doing well and was sickly. But in fact, they respected his privacy, and their respect and, you know, I guess people who really know him, their love for him, allowed them to keep that private. And that's not easy to do this day, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, now all of the stories are coming out on what was a carefully planned finale. And if you really look at the lyrics of Lazarus, in hindsight...
You mean the song Lazarus?
The song Lazarus.
The show is called, you know, you're confusing me. That's all. Okay, yeah.
You kind of go, oh, yeah, I see it now. Yeah. Look, the first line is, look at me now, I'm in heaven, basically. Yeah. Is the first line. So I'm a big David Bowie fan. When I was going through high school, I had a jacket with a David Bowie patch on it. I got teased mercilessly.
Did you have your glam phase?
No. It was a jacket that came with, you know, a David Bowie patch. And people were like, oh, you know, let's dance. Let's beat you up is more like it. So, you know, in the 80s, I guess it just wasn't cool to be a David Bowie fan. But now, of course, he's passed away.
I think you're high. Of course it was cool. Yeah. They were just uncool. What do you mean?
Exactly. Well, you know, back in the day.
It's not like you were a fan of Kasha Gugu. You were a fan of David Bowie. And he was a big star in the early 80s. His biggest commercial hits ever, practically.
Yes. And his last album, ironically, I was listening to yesterday.
This is Black Star.
Black Star. And I was like, wow.
Not ironically, it just came out Friday on his birthday.
Yes.
I mean, really, it just was, you know, it's heartbreaking, but it's lovely. He got to die, have his privacy, go out on his own terms, and, you know, go out on the top artistically. His album previous to this got great reviews, New Day, and was a very good album. And this album is getting good reviews even before his death. You know, it's not like a halo effect. And he had this off-Broadway show, which was not a good show, but by God, it was an artistic attempt, and it fell on its face nobly. You know what I mean? I mean, it was a flop, but it was, you know, flop trying to make art. It's like an East Village attempt to do a jukebox musical, something crazy and out there and, you know, utterly respectable in its floppiness.
Right.
You know?
I mean, and they were saying, look, this may work, it may not work, but let's try it anyway.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
But people lined up around the block because it was a Bowie involved in theater, and people were, you know, excited to see it. And that had to be, you know, kind of delightful at the end of his life to see the music still coming out and you know, people did. And of course, he has that tour, that museum tour. He's got an archival
exhibition, I believe.
Exhibition of clothing and video and all sorts of ephemera from his career that have been touring museums around the world to really extraordinary reviews, kind of like the best reviews for something so unconventional since, I think, Alexander McQueen. And that's really saying a lot because that was a sensation. But this Bowie tour has gotten tremendous reviews. I'm dying that I haven't been able to see it yet. But just that sense of him as an artist in so many different areas is really solidified in the last few years. Not that it was ever in doubt, but, you know, it's nice. He had a period of late 80s into the late 90s into the 2000s where he didn't do much that was interesting musically. I have a friend who would disagree, but I think that's fair to say for most people.
And I think he himself has said, you know, after Let's Dance and that album, okay, the name of which is completely escaping me now, which
Let's Dance was called Let's Dance.
That whole album?
I think so.
Okay. That was a great album.
I don't think so, but anyway.
And, you know, he said it was so successful and he got so much attention for it that he didn't necessarily know how to handle it. The next album, Glass Spiders, and he went on the Glass Spider tour, which was so overdone. And so, do you ever see him live?
I saw that tour, actually.
I saw that tour. I saw him several times after that, in fact.
So Let's Dance and then Tonight, Never Let Me Down, and then the Tin Machine era, you know. Yeah. So, yeah. You know. He was always interesting, always pushing forward. But, I mean, his run in the late 60s, early 70s was just tremendous, up through the Berlin Trilogy, which is, of course, his masterpiece. You know, Low, Heroes, and Lodger. That's just a great trilogy with Brian Eno. And really just, but it's just three of his many really great albums. So a hell of a talent. And frankly, he was also your internet provider, wasn't he, Sperling?
Yes, he was. In fact, I know that, you know, we talked about this before we started recording, and you wanted to know, why was I bringing up Bowie bonds? Now, Michael, you're quite well versed in this. Not a lot of people are, a lot of financial people are, but I was trying to figure out some way we could cover this story without kind of going through a list of his, you know, discography. But David Bowie in the mid-90s, he went and turned to a financial manager named Bill Ziplatt and a banker named David Pullman. And together they did what was called securitization of David Bowie's back catalog. So they took all of the rights, put them in a separate company, and then sold bonds in that company for 10 years. They, you know, whoever bought those bonds would reap the royalties, not David Bowie. So he would get $55 million up front. And then whoever owned the rights, those bonds, and it was Prudential Financial that purchased them for $55 million.
And it was a great deal for everybody.
It turned out to be a great deal. It was 1997 when he did it, okay? He took that money. He bought out his former manager, which cost about $25, $27 million. And then he invested in all these internet companies and tech companies because he believed that we would be downloading our music over this thing called the internet and these modems. And at the time I thought, huh, like war games?
He really said he was cashing out at the peak, he thought, because he told the New York Times in 2002 that music would become, quote, like running water or electricity, end quote. Well, yes. There you go. He predicted the decline in traditional music sales, and by God, he was right.
And a lot of people faulted him. Well, I don't want to say they faulted him, but a lot of people said, look, because of the internet, well, the value of those bonds would decline because the, you know, everything.
Well, that's why he sold them. Sell high and buy low.
Right. Piracy. You could get music.
Nobody faulted him if you bought them. But everybody made out okay on that deal. But people thought it was the wave of the future, and it wasn't, because a couple other artists tried it and then it petered out for various technical reasons.
Right. Well, the artist James Brown, for instance, tried it and they did fine and everybody did fine. But the reality is it's not really something you could do anymore because it's very risky. Thank you to pot, you know.
That's why you want a publishing catalog with a ton of stuff. Publishing is a great thing to own a piece of, right. But you don't want to have just one artist, one thing. You want to have 1,000 artists.
And in 2004, when those quote-unquote Bowie bonds were listed as junk bonds at that point, everybody said, oh, you see, it didn't work out. Well, guess what? Prudential Financial, in the 10 years they owned them, which is the length of the term that it was for, they earned 7.9% per year. So I think they walked away with something like $135, $155 million.
After paying out the 55 to Bowie?
Yeah. And by the way, guess what? David Bowie started his own ISP in 1998 called BowieNet. Okay.
I remember this.
And it was the thing about it, it was faster service. It was broadband before anybody knew what broadband was, which kind of actually enabled piracy. So. Bit of an issue there, but you know,
it was coming anyway. It was first.
It was coming anyway, and he saw it.
Yeah, he's an interesting, fascinating guy, and
yes.
I was kind of touched to see. I don't remember the last time I was touched on Facebook, but maybe some artist that meant a lot to me hasn't died while I've been on Facebook as such. But to see all the people that felt the need, desire to post something about it was kind of interesting to me. People in a lot of different areas of my life, a lot of them. We're up there talking about Bowie today. So it was kind of interesting to see the effect he has on people.
I was surprised too. I'm wondering if any of the people that beat me up in high school for wearing my David Bowie jacket were
He's
any...
the best,
yeah,
they said.
Exactly. But, you know, that concludes, well, not only the life of a legendary artist, but our show for this week. And you know what? You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. We remind you of that at the end of every single show. Please do rate and review the show on any one of those podcast aggregators. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find us. So please do subscribe to the show. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show, ways to follow us on Twitter, at showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can search for us on Facebook, where our page can be found under Showbiz Sandbox. You can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of that information can be found on our website. the music that you hear at the beginning and usually at the end of each show, except this week we're going to go out with one of David Bowie's...
Don't go over the fair use.
I won't go over the fair use, but it's a very prescient recent release called Lazarus that, as I mentioned, kind of...
It's not prescient. He knew he was dying.
True. We'll go out with that, but... Our title music this week was from MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is MGMT.com. I was hoping they'd play Coachella, but they're not. Michael, you have a new website every week. What is it this week?
Oh, thinwhiteduke.com.
Ooh, okay. A reference to David Bowie. But you know what? If you cannot find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not try, well, michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work aggregates. Or you can head on over to bookfilter.com, where you can read Michael's writing on the book industry and all of his book reviews. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Look up here. I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.